Hello and welcome to another episode of the Global Wire Conversation. Today I will be talking to John Yu of the University of California at Berkeley, where he's a law professor. John Yu is the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General during the George W. Bush administration and currently a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. John Yu co-hosts the Pacific Century podcast with Michael Oslin, which is broadly addressing developments in China and Asia. There they discuss the latest politics, economics, law, and cultural news with a focus on U.S. policy in the region. He also co-hosts Law Talk with Richard Epstein and Troy Senek, where they discuss the latest developments in law and politics. On our podcast today, we will be talking about his most recent book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, and whether or not Donald Trump is a constitutional populist, the Supreme Court, and differences in American and European politics. As always, if you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on YouTube or any other platform on which you enjoy podcasts. All right. So my first question is pertaining to your most recent book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, in which it looks like you take a very nuanced view on the relationship between President Trump, the Constitution, and the Supreme Court. The common stance, and this is something we also hear in Europe in the media, is that Donald Trump has been a wrecking ball to the constitutional order and a threat to American institutions. Observing his presidency over the last couple of years, how did your thinking evolve about him and his relationship to the Constitution, the US institutions, that you came to the conclusion now to describe him as a defender-in-chief of the Constitution?
Well, Ralph, it's great to be with you, and thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a great pleasure. I love doing podcasts with academics, you know, scholars who actually have read books and know things rather than people who are kind of just dropping in because it's controversial for the moment. So I think actually people have things backwards when they say that. It's actually Trump's opponents who I think who are the ones who are the wrecking ball or the bull in the china shop of the Constitution. That's not to deny that Trump has not been a great disruptive force in politics. And he's really changed the way the American president relates to the people, the way he interacts with the other institutions of society and culture. But I actually think when it comes to the presidency and its relationship to the other parts of the government, I think Trump has become this very unlikely defender of the Constitution. And the reason why is look at what's going on right now. It's people who I think have been so driven crazy by Trump and his effect on politics that they are willing to consider radical constitutional change in our country. Many people in the Democratic Party now want to replace the Electoral College with a direct vote for the president, which is not how we've chosen presidents in our country for 230 years. It's not Trump, it's his opponents who are now talking about increasing the size of the Supreme Court from 9 to 15 members. It's had 9 people since 1869, and we have a long tradition of not fiddling around to take advantage when one party's in power and expanding the size of the courts until it agrees with what we want. It's not Trump, but his opponents who want to make more Robert Mueller's and spread them all throughout the government to have these independent prosecutors who are going to monitor politics and use criminal prosecution investigation to try to monitor our policy disputes. It's not Trump, it's his opponents who want to nationalize our energy sector, nationalize our transportation sectors in the hopes of some Green New Deal. This has meant that Trump has been left the field by the left to rely on traditional constitutional practices and the examples of his predecessors. And that's why I say it's no one would have thought that 4 years ago. But I think the political response to Trump has been so extreme that that is the side that's actually contemplating overthrowing our normal constitutional order. And Trump is just left with the rest of the field to himself.
I think it's important to mention that you yourself at the beginning, and I think even now, you have a very critical view towards the president, and you have not been a supporter of him in 2016. So I think is it fair to say that initially you also were concerned that this might be a real test for the U.S. Constitution and for U.S. political institutions?
Oh, yes. That's why I say it's the most surprising thing. 4 years ago, I thought Trump would be a problem for the Constitution because he's a populist. And populists come to office thinking we've got to throw out the existing order, right? We have to change the status quo. Usually the Constitution is the most permanent part of the status quo. So 4 years ago, I didn't support Trump, and I've been critical of him at times. I've probably been more critical about his personal conduct in the office than his constitutional arguments. And what was really disturbed me are the attacks on him. I think they've become so unhinged that they are either misreading the Constitution or they are threatening to do away with important safeguards that limit and try to channel democracy in useful ways rather than giving in to trying to stoke this kind of majoritarian response to Trump in an effort to get rid of him.
Do you think this is a little bit of a stretch probably, but would it be appropriate to label Trump something like a constitutional populist? Meaning that he's not so much moved by a textualist or an originalist interpretation of the Constitution, but he feels an obligation towards his conservative base. So he feels that it's that an adherence to U.S. institutions is kind of what is needed for him to mobilize his base. So there is actually a populist movement in the United States that is deeply attached to the Constitution, which is quite interesting because there's nothing comparable to that, for example, in Europe, where there's such faith in a written document or in the idea expressed by a written document that a populist is actually not running on I'm going to break it and I'm going to be the strong man doing everything, but actually by an expressed faith in the document.
Ralph, that's a great point to compare to Europe, because in Europe, constitutions are just instruments of the time. you have one now, works. Yeah, if it doesn't work anymore, you get rid of it and bring in a new one, right? It doesn't have any value beyond.
But there's a new French Republic every 10 years.
Yeah, there's a terrible joke, in the American library, that's you find the French Constitution in the periodical section. But I think in America, the Constitution has a different status. It's beyond just a useful instrument of government, in part because we're not a single people. I think if you're Austrian or you're French, your people existed before your current Constitution. Right? You have a lot of things that bind you together, culture, history, so on. And the United States is an amalgamam of lots of different peoples from all over the world. So the thing that binds everybody together in the United States is the Constitution. So that's one thing. The second thing I think is you make an excellent point. Trump is a populist, but what he's using his power is to reinforce the Constitution, not to attack it. And usually in Europe and the United States, you usually see populists have the opposite attitude. And not only that, you go farther and say he's a strange populist in that he's come to office and he's actually in many ways tried to reduce the size and power of government. You don't often see populists who say, the people demand less government, right? Usually they demand something more from government. But in office, Trump has been doing a lot to try to reduce the size and importance of Washington, D.C., and to allow more local and state government, even when it hurts his political fortunes. For example, the performance in the pandemic. The Constitution, I think, properly read, gives the primary job for public health and safety to the state and local governments in the United States. Trump has an enormous political incentive to try to take over the whole thing, to dictate everybody wear masks, or open and close all the businesses in the country. But he hasn't. Actually, he's been fairly respectful of that balance between national and local government, even though it hurts him politically.
There seems to be a very interesting thing in general on the political right in the United States, that if we trace it back to 2010 and the Tea Party movement, that there is a populist right in the United States that is actually an anti-government intervention populist right. I think this was quite interesting during the economic crisis. In Europe, you had demonstrations, why isn't the government doing more? The government needs to bail us out. In the United States, you had demonstrations that said, if the government would more or less just keep out of my business, things would go better, which it would be a separate debate whether that was the right or wrong approach. But the simple fact that such a movement existed, and it seems that to some extent, this is carried over into the Trump area. And the Trump was speaking to a frustration, particularly with conservatives, who felt that every time they voted for an individual with an R behind their name, they might
they might were able to get a Republican into office, but they never really felt that they get a Republican into power. And with Trump, despite his imperfections and him being an absolutely probably imperfect vessel for conservative values, he ended up governing probably more conservative than previous Republican presidents. So kind of this is because many people in Europe don't understand, well, why can conservatives vote for Donald Trump? How can evangelicals vote for Donald Trump? Well, because it seems that despite his personality flaws, he's more of a conservative in governing style. He's more conservative than many others from on the right have been before him, at least in recent memory.
Maybe one way to put it is that Trump is not the cause, he's the effect. He does well because there's already this movement in the United States, which doesn't have strong parallels in Europe, of a popular anti-government party, which I think is actually quite a consistent theme in America. You know, Ronald Reagan was also part of that, right? He came to Washington to make it smaller. And so Trump, he reacted to that and sort of embraced it, and that brought him to power. Trump didn't cause it. As you say, it was here, at least through the Tea Party. I would argue it goes back even farther. Some American political scientists think that's one of the things that makes America exceptional, is this hostile attitude to government, which you don't see so permanently in European politics. And then I think Trump is a clever politician. You know, he does have this kind of, for good or ill, he has this kind of instinct for what people like. And so while his personal view might be to live his life as a libertine, while he's been very controversial in business, but he became the vessel for what this group in America wanted. And that's the other thing about, he's kept his word to them. So, you know, a lot of people, including me, were worried that once he got into office, he would govern as something else. But actually, he's governed in a very conservative way. He didn't actually break his word to all those people that you're talking about.
There is this, and this is again something that distinguishes Europe a little bit, and you see this partially probably also on the American left. There is, and I'm simplifying here, of course, the historical context, but in the United States, there is still this idea that there are natural rights that precede government, and government is instituted to protect those rights. In continent, and I think that's also partially true, I would say, in the British political tradition, in continental Europe, particularly in the German, but also in the French and Russian context, the idea is much stronger that government is the grantor of rights, and the government in extreme cases can also take those rights back, that they bestow it upon the people, but they can suspend them when they see fit. And it seems that their thinking at least partially has also seeped into maybe parts of the, and I'm trying to say this as careful as possible, also the bureaucratic class in Washington D.C. and the United States. And I think you could see this a little bit in the impeachment debate, but also in the investigations into Trump regarding the connections with Russia, where a lot of the things that he was accused of were not so much, if at all, kind of was criminal behavior, but that he swayed away from what was the usual way how it was done. Whether it's constitutional, or the president has a lot to say in foreign policy, and he was doing, I mean, and I think in many respects now he has been proven correct, whether it's in the case of Israel and other areas, but he has kind of swayed from what was the accepted performance, and this kind of then led to kind of what was then was called whistleblowing, which in many cases was just a dissatisfaction with his policy course that he had every right to chart for his own as the president.
But yeah, I could quite agree with you. And I tried to put this in sharp relief. Maybe it's sharper, not as sharp in reality, but in the, well, as academics, we can do that, right? We're allowed to make things clearer than they actually are. And so I tried to say, in one way, to understand Trump and all the controversies, was that it's a war between this 18th century American theory of government, natural rights, right? Narrow government power, right? This is why we're so crazy about guns, for example. That really is a good symbol of the American idea, oh, there's a natural right pre-existing government to have weapons. Whereas the more modern 20th century view of government is everything is a technical question. scientific question, expert question. Those people should not be involved in politics at all who decide those questions. Keep them isolated and insulated. Let them use their expertise for society. The 18th century is everything must be under the control of politics because that's, you know, we the people give the government very limited powers and we want to control that government so it doesn't oppress us. And so I look at all these issues, as you suggest, with impeachment, I agree. Also the Russia collusion investigation. These are conflicts between a president who is the politician in charge of law enforcement. He's the politician under the Constitution in charge of foreign policy against a foreign service with impeachment or the FBI and the CIA and the national security bureaucracy who say this guy's unfit, right? He doesn't know, he can't be allowed to decide what's a national interest. He can't be allowed to conduct his unconventional disruptive foreign policies or his disruptive attitude to law enforcement. He's a, you could see impeachment, Russia collusion, everything is a conflict to me of this 18th century American vision of government as really political and narrow versus the 20th century, I do call it European style government that Woodrow Wilson and FDR brought to America, which is technocratic, independent, superior to politics in some way. Every time Trump is fighting, he's trying to restore the 18th century Constitution's control over that 20th century government, which I personally think is becoming obsolete for a lot of reasons anyway. So again, Trump is a cause, not the effect, but he is responding to, I think, the crumbling of this 20th century consensus about progressive government.
I would be amiss not to ask you, because I'm sure that many of our listeners are very curious about your take on this. Over the last couple of weeks, there has been an increasing number of revelations that the trigger for the investigation into the Trump campaign regarding their involvement or the potential collusion with Russia or that there has been some malfeasance, if not illegality, that maybe this was much more driven by desire, at least by some players within the FBI, to, between quotation marks, find dirt on Donald Trump and maybe prevent his ascension to the president, than by goodwill and a serious suspicion that something bad was going on, right? that the so-called, the now infamous Steele dossier and the sources of the Steele dossier. What is your take on this? I'm surprised that in the media this is, and I don't use the word, you know, scandal of the century a lot because it's an overused term, but this is a very, very important and very significant development, because it shows, I think, also what you just mentioned, that there are parts of the bureaucracy kind of who seem, again, parts, this is not an indictment of the majority of men and women, particularly the FBI, who do a very honorable and difficult job, but that some parts of the bureaucracy seem to take it upon them to decide who they think is supposed to be in power and who is not.
It's a great question, and I think you're right. I think it is quite scandalous, but we haven't gotten to the bottom of it. But let me give you, and I talk about it some in my book, let me give you some, so the way I look at it, which is, this is an example of this idea that there is a part of the government, here the prosecutors, that are superior to politics. They thought they could decide who's fit to be president, not the voters, but themselves, acting out of what they thought is their professional judgment. They were easily duped into believing that Trump had something to do with Russian intelligence. The more we learn, the more it looks like this was all just Russian disinformation designed to sow chaos in the United States. But because these bureaucracies were so repulsed by Trump's unconventional disruptive nature, they were all too ready to believe it. And then once they came to that conclusion, they crossed what I think of a red line in American politics. The lesson we learned after Watergate, which was never use the powers of government, especially those that are to protect us from foreign spies and terrorists and rival governments, don't use those powers to interfere domestically with a presidential campaign. That's what Watergate should have taught us. And there are a bunch of laws like FISA, all these laws you keep hearing about, they're all passed after Watergate to stop that from happening again. But when it came down to it, these bureaucracies and the FBI in place and the Obama administration they had so convinced themselves that Trump was somehow mixed up with the Russians that they were willing to, again, override any of these guardrails that had been created to contain this national security powers to make sure it didn't infect our domestic politics. And you can see the destruction that it causes when we allow that to happen, just as we saw it happened in Watergate. Again, I don't think that it'll just be swept under the rug, that it'll be forgotten. I think we're going to have more and more details come out. I think people are already astounded by what has happened. And Congress and a prosecutor are both looking into it. And the story is by no means over. The election will come and go, but the investigations are continuing even now.
Do you think that maybe one it's always, one should always refrain from doing kitchen sink psychology, but do you think that one of the reasons why the particularly the Russian narrative, or the in general the narrative that the election victory of Donald Trump in 2016 was possible because there was some nefarious, powerful, hidden play in the background, because it was so hard to believe for his political opponents that he actually won the election, that kind of this person that, and there have been many kind of collages where everybody was convinced, probably until the results of the election came in, that he's not going to win. It's impossible. Donald Trump will not be president of the United States. And then this was kind of psychologically such an earthquake of an event that in the search for an answer why this happened, the most convenient answer was one to say, well, he won because there was this whatever it then was in detail, supposedly because there was this Russian intervention, because one could not believe that a figure like Donald Trump in all his crassness, his appearance, his conversation style, that he could actually win the election.
I guess maybe I would say it a little differently, but it's a similar point, was just that Trump was a good candidate, Hillary Clinton was a terrible candidate, and Trump got lucky. I mean, you have a few tens of thousands of votes switch in a few Midwestern states, and Hillary Clinton still would have won, despite her deficiencies as a candidate. But as I agree with you, it is so shocking. You know, I think it was like maybe at best a 1 in 5, 1 in 10 chance Trump would win. But on that day, he pulled, you know, he pulled the right cards during his poker game. I think if you go back and look at that night, Trump looks surprised that he won. Right? When he gives, you know, when they show pictures of him and he gives his, you know, victory speech, he looks like he's shocked. But I think you're right. That so unsettles people that they. One way to understand the last 4 years is, for the last 4 years, unlike with previous presidencies, this president has had to live with a consistent attack on his legitimacy in office. You know, you can have disputes about what's the right healthcare policy or the right foreign policy, but his opponents have spent a lot of time just trying to claim that he did not really win the election, or that he had cheated, or that some foreign government had intervened, which I think is unhealthy for the democracy and also just untrue. I mean, he won under the existing rules. You could say the existing rules are unfair, but he played by those rules. But what has meant is that we have consumed as a society enormous resources, essentially refighting the 2016 election.
I mean, I don't want to engage in partisan politics, but there seems to be a trend, and this goes back because you, of course, also worked for the George W. Bush administration. Mm-hmm. But starting in 2000 with the election of George W. Bush, then we had in 2018, or there was the debate on whether the gubernatorial elections in Georgia, who won, the then Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams is still convinced that she actually won the contest in Georgia. There was an argument that in Florida, actually, Andrew Gillum has won the election. So there has been a tendency on the political left, at least some parts of the political left in the United States, where it seems it's the default mode after an important lost election is, it was either voter suppression, or the election was outright stolen, or it was illegitimate. And I think this is befuddling also kind of to all sides, left and right of the aisle. And we saw it also now when Hillary Clinton advises Joe Biden to not concede the election under any circumstances. So there is and then once again, right, Trump himself, he steps into it himself saying, well, we'll see at election eve whether or not I accept the results. So this is kind of that both sides chip away at the legitimacy of the institutions, because it's going to be very difficult to, and it's going to be one way or another to be a close election, and that you know, 51% explained to the other 49 that no, this was a legitimate election, when the other half or almost half will most certainly feel encouraged by their leadership on the right and on the left that this was an illegitimate election. That seems to me like a much bigger threat to the institutions than who in the end wins the election.
And so, yeah, I agree. So this is both sides are attacking the institutions that carry out the counting, essentially. I wouldn't say this is new, but it's new in our recent times. I mean, of course, George Bush won in 2000, but the result was accepted as legitimate, although it took the Supreme Court to intervene. But the other point I wanted to make is that the founders of the Constitution, they had just lived through a period of upheaval, revolution, military coups, and so on. And so the Constitution actually does have provisions for what you do when these elections are too close to call or there's no majority. And it has a whole backup system, which we rarely use. We've probably used it 3 or 4 times in the last 230 years. So I think that as long as what you started out with, as long as the American people still believe the Constitution itself is legitimate and they still feel a commitment to it, then suppose these attacks on voting continue, and this November, we don't really have an answer who actually won under the normal November 3rd vote. Then there's a whole system in the Constitution that gets thrown into the House, gets thrown into the Senate for a decision to pick the president. And I hope that the American people still accept that result, just as they have in the past. We just haven't had to resort to it because our elections haven't been this close. Everything we're talking about is also the result of a country that's very closely divided. I mean, you might say who wins depends on what day you hold the election, right? It could be on November 3rd, you could have a different result than on November 4th because it's so close and depends on who just shows up to vote. So it's not just polarization, but it's also that just the country's divided almost 50-50 exactly.
You mentioned the founding idea and the founders. One of the things that has become quite interesting in recent years is, in the vision of the founders, the judicial branch was supposed to be the weakest branch, since it had neither power over the famous quote, over the sword or the purse. What has changed in recent years? And you mentioned, for example, that which I think is very true, the legitimacy of the Constitution is kind of still a core element of the American creed or kind of the American identity. And the Supreme Court, kind of as its guardian, is still one of the most revered and legitimate institutions in the United States. But do you think that the increasing politicization of the Supreme Court, that this might also become a problem, and this is not exactly how the founders probably would have envisioned the role of the Supreme Court?
Yes, I would say that is true, descriptively true, that the Supreme Court has become more powerful, it has become more political, and because of that, it has also suffered more political attacks and become more involved with political campaigns. What you saw with the Kavanaugh nomination, what you're probably going to see with the Barrett nomination, is the application of regular political campaign tactics applied to the courts, which is terrible. I think that's terrible for the system. But I think the cause of that is the Supreme Court itself. So I think what's happened is that over the last 50 years, our Supreme Court is steadily expanding the control of the courts over issues that are really controversial, important to people, and used to be in the hands of the political system. So take abortion as the big issue in the United States, which, you know, I know friends in other countries, they are deeply puzzled why abortion is the defining issue of our politics, but it is. And that until Roe versus Wade in 1973, that is not an issue that's in the courts. That's up to the political system. The states decide by elections and their representatives whether to have abortion. Once the court takes that issue and makes it a constitutional, right? This is described in Tocqueville very nicely. Once the courts make that a legal issue, then the only way to change policy or affect it at all is to fight over who goes on the Supreme Court. And so it's no surprise that when this court starts expanding its influence over these issues, politics comes and focuses on them and not Congress and the states anymore. Some people also say, and I agree, that the politicians don't mind it this way, right? If you want to win re-election to Congress, the best thing is if somebody else votes on abortion, not you, right? And that, so you could say Congress is complicit in this conspiracy. But I don't think it's healthy for every issue in politics to eventually turn into a constitutional issue that's decided by a 5-justice majority on the Supreme Court rather than the, you know, the people acting through elections.
I mean, in your opinion, and this is, might be something of a little bit of a more provocative question, but I'll be very curious about your take. Do you think there have been some cases, whether it was abortion would be one example, gay marriage might be another, where it might would have been wiser from by the Supreme Court to kind of to abstain from taking these cases, to say that this is something that must run through the kind of the cultural political process?
Yes, okay. I think that's the best thing to happen would be if the court had said, regardless of what you think about abortion, you're pro-life or pro-choice, this is not an issue of the constitutional, this is not an issue of constitutional dimension. The courts will not decide the case. You know, you, the politicians, you, the people decide it. I think that would have been a healthy thing for democracy on not just abortion, but as you say, a lot of other issues. Gay marriage would be another good example. Why can't you, so I always say to you, well, in the United States, where you get subjected to the death penalty depends on what state you're in when you kill somebody. Whether you can engage in euthanasia depends what state you're in, right? The states already exercise the power of life and death. Why is abortion different? Why is gay marriage different? Why shouldn't those equally important issues be left to politics? That's what politics is for.
Do you think this that it might be that this has been a small flaw in the design of the founders, that they give, and we see this in the writings of Lincoln, kind of the particular the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, how these two documents are so fundamental to the entire American political system, not just technically but also emotionally, that even though it is correct that the Supreme Court has neither purse nor sword, but they are, and I mean this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, that they are like a class of high priests guarding the most important document, that the political, and again, I mean no disrespect to anybody of faith, but kind of the political Bible, if you will, of the American political creed, so that that is such a potential cultural power or an influential power the Supreme Court holds, that they don't need a purse, they don't need a sword, that simply their role as these guardians of the most important document gives them tremendous political power. And what you just mentioned is that because their decisions are generally viewed as legitimate, even in these contentious issues, but that might be, for lack of a better word, is some form of social capital, if you will, that the Supreme Court has, and that people who would be or who would reject certain decisions, that they accept them, but that there might be a breaking point. That, for example, conservative America might accept Roe versus Wade. They might accept the ruling in gay marriage, but that particularly with the question of packing the courts that now comes up, that at some point they say, okay, this is just another political institutions that is split up along partisan lines, and that's it. That this is something maybe the founders have underestimated.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to what you say. We call it legitimacy. You know, what is the legitimacy of the court? So you're right. The court doesn't have any power of compulsion to it. It can't force people to obey its decisions, unlike right, the Congress, which has the power of legislation, or the executive branch, which controls the sword. That's what that famous quote, I think, by Hamilton means, that it has neither the sword nor the, it doesn't have force, it doesn't have will, it only has judgment. And by that, it means that people obey it because they are persuaded by it. And so I agree, as long as the court's decisions appear to be the product of faithful interpretation of the Constitution and not policy, not reading one's own preferences into the Constitution, then it retains that legitimacy, which is just voluntary agreement of the people to obey its decisions. And yet, because it's attached, as you say, almost culturally so tightly to the Constitution, which is the thing that holds the country together, they benefit from being so close to it. I think in Europe, this seems, you know, I think the European Union has tried this, but it has failed. Like, I don't think they wanted to also claim a kind of technocratic adherence to, you know, the original, the founding treaties or the European Union agreements. But in fact, there's a huge deficit of legitimacy in the European Union institutions, and the peoples of Europe don't find their decisions legitimate because I don't think they explain them and they don't make sense. They don't receive that kind of voluntary acceptance. But it's not acceptance, it's agreement in a way, right? So it's the idea that even though you might disagree with the court, you accept its decision because you find it reasonable, that because you think they're right, they are, that's why they issue opinions. That's the other thing I might mention that's a difference is when the executive branch or Congress do anything, they just act. They don't give a list of reasons why they did it. The court, the whole, everything we read is just 20, 30, 40 pages explaining why they reached this choice. They're unique in the government in doing that because they need us to, they need the people to agree voluntarily. Yeah.
This, do you think it would be a fair characterization, for example, if we take Chief Justice John Roberts, that he seems to be quite aware of the very delicate position the Supreme Court has these days within the entire political but also cultural framework of the United States, that he, because he very often is presented a little bit of as a disappointment, particularly for conservatives. He was appointed by George W. Bush, so there once again the hope was that this would be a textualist, originalist. But it seems that John Roberts is well aware that that sometimes the Supreme Court, that this, I think it's interesting whether one should agree or disagree with this, that the Supreme Court has to maintain a balance. It's almost as if sometimes the Supreme Court kind of has to side with the left, the Supreme Court sometimes has to side with the right and thereby maintain its legitimacy with the entirety of the country, even though from a purely textualist viewpoint, many decisions that were supported by John Roberts were somewhat problematic, right? Whether it was kind of to interpret the Affordable Care Act as a tax and in some other areas as well, but that, or the something you have also talked in a couple of interviews now, for example, the handling of certain decisions by the Obama administration regarding migration, like DACA and these things, that the Supreme Court was unwilling, or was a majority was unwilling to take it back, even though constitutionally probably it was an unconstitutional decision to begin with. So do you think that this is, yes, where John Roberts kind of tries to strike a balance between being purely a constitutional judge, but also trying to preserve what we were just talking about, the legitimacy of the Supreme Court?
Yes, I think, you know, you could say with Roberts, who's the Chief Justice, he feels a tension between getting the right answer, right, does the Constitution really say, versus being aware of the court's political standing and not wanting people to believe it has become a political institution. And so keeping to precedent, you know, keeping, not overthrowing the decisions of the government too often. Even though he knows that what the government has done might be unconstitutional, like with the immigration decision policies you were just mentioning, because he doesn't want the Supreme Court to be a political target in a presidential campaign. So the classic example was Obamacare, you know, the Obama administration's effort to create a national healthcare system. John Roberts voted to strike down 80% of it, but he still upheld the last fifth because he didn't want the Supreme Court to be a target in the presidential election year then, and being said that the Supreme Court had taken away people's healthcare benefits. And so I think that's a good example of what you're talking about, where the politics for him took precedence over getting the Constitution right. Now, I'd say Lincoln has a good discussion of this, because I think Lincoln believed that the court's only legitimacy really came because it was willing to do what was right. And he would not want the court to think about where its political position was at all. Just do what's right and then let the political system take care of the response and the consequences. And you remember Lincoln countenanced some very extreme attitudes to the court, where he said, well, I don't have to agree with the Supreme Court. They can have their opinions. I don't have to agree with them or give them any force. All I have to do is carry out their judgment in a single case. If they say I have to take this freed slave and give them back to the slave owner, I will do it in that one case. But for the other hundreds of thousands of cases, I'm going to do what I want because I'm an equal branch of government. I interpret the Constitution too. I'm not bound by the Supreme Court. That's the most extreme example of a president attacking a court. But I think it was justified because the Dred Scott decision he was responding to was a case where the court was utterly political and got things wrong because they thought they could solve the slavery problem in the United States. And in fact, it had the exact opposite result.
Right, because it would then turn the Supreme Court into like a super legislature, which is not
it was not the founder's idea that the court should answer all these questions for society at the end. Yeah.
Do you think that is it healthy for the political system that there is now almost a cult of personality regarding Supreme Court justices? And I know from, I think this is something that maybe also some listeners didn't know, that, for example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Scalia, they had a very good personal relationship. So I think within the court, within the justices, it probably has been less tense than it is outside the courtroom. But you see it now after the death of the late Justice Ginsburg, this idea that now her dying wish needs to be respected, and this very idea that the Supreme Court is no longer this institution as the Supreme Court, but it's really these a cynical commentator on one side is kind of these nine roped kind of priest like figures who then as you said before, right, it's not, even if the Supreme Court decides, it's very often a 5-4 decision, so it's basically five people then decide what an entire legislature could not decide.
I have to think our European friends must be so confused when they see pictures of Ruth Bader Ginsburg on T-shirts, coffee mugs, children's books, silverware. It makes no sense at all. But it puzzles me too. Why have some of these justices become cultural icons? In fact, very different than their personal natures. I mean, Justice Ginsburg was a very shy, sort of unassuming person. She was not a celebrity hound, publicity hound by any means. But I think you're right. It's a political and cultural phenomenon. One of it is that because they themselves have become so important with the political power that the court wields, then they're individually becoming like politicians, the way we know who they are, what they look like. We're curious about their details. I would say 30, 40 years ago, Supreme Court justices could walk around Washington, D.C., and no one would know who they were. And that's not true anymore. Another thing I think is maybe it also goes to your point earlier about the court and being almost priestly. As politics has become more combative and polarized and divided, the court maybe represents this kind of utopian vision of politics where nine people just get together and they reason through decisions and they have a majority and a dissent, but they politely argue with each other. It's all at the realm of big ideas and theories. And maybe that's what people respond to because politics has become so combative now. They wish for this, but that's not done right. That's not politics, right? That's legal reasoning. And they should be different and kept distinct.
One thing, and because you mentioned earlier today also Woodrow Wilson, I think there is one, again, I'm then trying not to be political, but it's there is a distinction between the when we talk about the struggle regarding the Supreme Court, together in the Woodrow Wilson ideal, and I think you worked this out quite nicely, is the idea that government is supposed to be technocratic. We know what the problems are, we know the solutions, it's now only to execute the right solutions. So the metaphysical debates are over. And I think we see this also regarding the Supreme Court, kind of the conservative approach is one that there the desire is to have judges or justices that preserve the originalist or textualist meaning of the Constitution and not have it as a super legislature. On the left, in the tradition of Woodrow Wilson, it seems that there is a stronger willingness to view the Supreme Court as a form of super legislature. So there is, it's not because in Europe, when now there's again, of course, reporting with the open seat, there's as well, it's going to be a majority of of conservative judges and Europeans in their own hysterical, and I can say this because I'm a European myself, in their own hysterical approach. So, well, there will be then as a majority of all, and everything will be banned, and America will turn into a theocracy. But there was a conservative, at least on paper, conservative majority for quite a while. But many decisions, again, from gay marriage, all these kind of things, have been made with a conservative majority, because once again, the idea was to preserve whatever then the idea was, and I think there is a lot of room for disagreement, to maintain the spirit of the Constitution. But on the particular, on the progressive side, and I'm not using the party, I'm not saying the Democrat, but on the progressive side, there is this idea that just like other institutions, the Supreme Court is an institution that is supposed to be captured, and if it doesn't work kind of by natural progression, you need to pack the court, which is exactly the debate that is currently on. So there is a difference there.
I agree. No. There's a big difference because I hope people in Europe understand that when the conservative majority takes over at the Supreme Court, they're only talking about sending the decisions back to the legislatures. You know, the Supreme Court's not going to actually make any choice about abortion under a conservative majority. Whether we're going to have abortion or not then becomes up to California or Texas or Massachusetts. I think the reason why progressives so favor having the Supreme Court as a super legislature is because it fits with their idea of bureaucracy, which, I mean, I think Wilson got it from you guys. I mean, he got it from Weber and German bureaucracy. He was quite an admirer of the bureaucracy as it's practiced by the Germans. And if you think that agencies are better because they're insulated and separate from politics and they use expertise, well, then the Supreme Court is the highest expression of that idea. And so progressives like the Supreme Court because it's not subject to the checks and balances of the legislative process or politics or presidential veto or the House and the Senate. You can do whatever you want if you have five votes. Right? If you know what the right answer is, and I think that's something also maybe distinguishes liberals and conservatives in the United States, liberals I think are more persuaded about what the right answer is, whereas conservatives are much more risk averse, I think. But if you know what the right answer for every problem is, why should you let a separation of powers get in your way? Right? If you should just implement it as quickly as possible, whether through bureaucracy or better yet, through the courts. Yeah. And I think that's a big difference between progressives and conservatives.
On there's one thing I was very curious to ask your opinion on, because it's more a meta level question, and that is more about your work in the past during the George W. Bush administration. How do you view in general the applicability of law from a social contract perspective? For example, this has been an ongoing debate, and it's also a debate in Europe. Should a captured terrorist have access to all the privileges and protections that the Constitution is granting, even though they have never been part of the social contract, if we kind of view the Constitution as a social contract that led to its formation? And in many cases, of course, particularly in the area of ideological terrorism, they are explicitly hostile towards the values that have been expressed in the Constitution.
Yes, I think that the America is still exists in a Lockean universe, if you might say it that way. And that, as you said, the American Constitution almost froze political theory in our country to believe that everybody has natural rights that pre-exist the government, and that we give up only a limited set of those when we enter into society and create a government. And that if you're from outside that society, you don't have the same level of rights because you're not part of the community. Especially, as you say, people from the outside who want to destroy or overthrow that system. And so that's why traditionally American law has treated enemies in wartime completely differently than they treat even criminals within the peacetime system. I think that the courts have extended some rights to terrorists, but they still have nowhere near the kinds of rights that a citizen would have, even a citizen who's being prosecuted for a crime. And so I think that difference still reflects this kind of law, as you say, this Lockean social contract vision of the Constitution of rights, which I know is very different than Europeans have in terms of your theories of rights and government. But I think that's where another thing that the Constitution does, it almost freezes that into place. I mean, to overthrow that vision would mean you'd have to change the Constitution to do it. And so far, all three branches of our government are in agreement, I think, on this point, that even after 9/11 with terrorists, terrorists are of the same nature as a foreign army, members of a foreign army that we fight.
Yeah, because this has been a little bit the a contentious issue. And it's the same in Europe, right? For example, the debate, if somebody, for example, in Austria, we had a couple of cases, somebody goes to Syria and fights for ISIS, right? Should that person still have the right to hold an Austrian passport, or should actually the Austrian government say, listen, you decided to fight for a state-like entity or a self-declared state, and you cannot hold at the same time an Austrian passport. And there was also a debate in Canada where Justin Trudeau kind of had this very emotional scene where he said, a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. And the counter-argument was, no, right? But once you move, you swear allegiance to another country, and that country pretty much declares war on your original home country, in this case, the Canadian country, you cannot then, when it suits you, as the person that moved and fought for ISIS, say, you know what, that was just that I had a bad day, and now I'm kind of reclaiming my Canadian citizenship. So this is really, I think, an ongoing debate, whether this is something that can be taken away, or whether it's even citizenship, right? Is it a right or is it a privilege? And I think this has, particularly also after 9/11, that doesn't seem to have been fully resolved. So I think you said it beautifully, that we kind of still live in a Lockean world, but in another perspective as well, that the world would be governed by these Lockean liberal principles. It's just not everybody knows about it. So there's still kind of this belief that if we expose people long enough to the Western way of life, that they will voluntarily kind of join the philosophy, join the belief system, join the values. So it seems that in the United States, as much as in Europe, we still don't really know how to handle, for example, people that went to the Middle East and fought for ISIS, or people that joined Al-Qaeda and conducted 9/11. That seems to be still something that maybe, and I don't want to go on a rant here, but just as a concluding remark on this, that seemed to be handled, between quotation marks, much more straightforward in the 19th century, when there still kind of wasn't a clear definition of what treason is, with all the consequences that it was bearing.
Well, maybe another way to think of it, and I think this is the result, it's a consequence of this, is that you get the Trump administration. I don't think the Trump administration is the cause there. The effect is this renewed interest in national sovereignty, nation-state sovereignty, that I think after World War II, we had these hopes, as you mentioned, that we would expose the world to liberal ideas, Lockean liberal ideas, that they would come around, they would change and want to join that community that's primarily located in Western Europe, the United States, and then East Asia. It didn't happen. Francis Fukuyama's theory that the end of history was upon us in this kind of Hegelian way was wrong. Actually, I think Sam Huntington, his Clash of Civilizations, unfortunately turned out to be right. And you have parts of the world, you could say China or the Middle East, reject as a sort of liberal Lockean theory of the world. And so we lived in a kind of dream world is too strong, but we had this utopian view after World War II and really after the end of the Cold War that we could change the world into another Western Europe or North America. And we were rudely reawakened on 9/11 and then the year since that wasn't going to happen. And so I read as a result of that, a consequence that great power rivalries have returned. Nation-state sovereignty, to me, is the only real way to protect the rights of people within a community against a revival of great power competition. And so it's not a surprise to me that Trump and other countries, Austria too, other countries have a renewed interest in nation-state sovereignty. And part of sovereignty is deciding who's part of your community and who's not part of your community. Yeah.
So I would be amiss if I wouldn't ask as my final question. I mean, I would love to keep you for another hour, but to kind of conclude. So, what was your impression of the first presidential debate? I think it would be a horrible mistake not to ask you. I think it's a necessity for me to get your take on this.
Yeah, stylistically, it was terrible. Oh, it was entertaining. I mean, that's what Americans love, entertainment. But substantively, nothing was learned. So I would say, tactically, Trump won in the sense that he came out with a lot of energy. He avoided the mistakes of past incumbents who usually have terrible first debates. He was very combative with Biden, but I think he lost strategically. I think Biden won at the strategic level because all Biden had to do was show that he was competent, that he could give comprehensible answers, that he could stand up to someone badgering him like Trump. And since he's 5 or 6 points ahead, all he had to do was not make any grave errors. You know, Trump is now the underdog, so he had to really, you know, upend the race with the debate, and that didn't happen. And so I think in the broader, so tactically Trump won, but strategically Biden succeeded in preventing any Waterloos from happening too.
If you, if I put on kind of my ignorant European hat, how would you explain to somebody who doesn't follow politics as closely as you did over the last decades, that now in 2020, when we look at the presidential stage, we have two over 70-year-old yes. white men, as one would say, one who has been in politics for 47 years, the other one who's been in politics for 4.7 minutes, comes out of entertainment. I mean, on the one hand, one could say this is the greatness of America that you have this, but this is...
Anybody really can become president.
Exactly, but doesn't this kind of it's almost a little bit of a mockery kind of so many debates that have been taken on about diversity and kind of the idea that there's the youth movement and there's all this new energy in politics when you say, yeah, that was all interesting talk, but look who the candidates actually are.
You know, I would not have predicted this outcome 4 years ago, but you could see, it's interesting. I think they're almost symbolic of two completely different approaches to politics. Now, we have such a choice for us in America. One is Trump. It's not because he was old. If you remember the primaries, it's because he was the most anti-establishment outsider you could have picked from both parties. He's someone who'd never been part of politics. He was a reality show host, circus leader, ringleader in a circus. You know, he was so outside the, but the reason he succeeded is because so many Americans were fed up with the establishment and the way things had been running for decades. I mean, I was part of that government that people were upset about. On the other hand, Biden, his age is a reflection of he is the establishment. As you say, he's been around for 47 years. He's been part of every major decision and fight. So you really have the most outsider you could have versus the most establishment person, right? The other nominees in the Democratic race were all various outsiders too, and they all lost. The Democratic Party chose to go with the most inside candidate they could have picked. He's held every office you were supposed to have before president. And so, yes, I think the age itself is just, it was by chance. But because of their relationship to the establishment is how they eventually won. So I think it's a very clear and stark choice. So in this respect, we've become more like Europe. So, you know, the American political scientists used to complain all the time that our political parties papered over differences and pushed to the middle. But now we have a European-style political system. We have a clear left and right choice. There's no middle. There's no moderating tendency in the political parties. We really have a clear ideological difference now. I tell my political science friends, be careful what you wish for, because you all wanted to have European-style parties and politics, and now you have it, and it looks a lot worse than what we had before.
It's funny, because I made exactly the same argument in my class that with, at least with Trump, European style populism has now arrived in, yes. in the United States. Even the picking of the topics, the anti-establishment, anti-elites, the migration issues, this has been a burning issue in Europe for years.
Yeah, so I think you're
absolutely right. Yeah.
Yes.
All right, Professor Yu, I once again would like to recommend to my listeners your most recent book among many that you have written, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. It was a great pleasure having you, and I hope that we can do this again in the future.
Yes, me too. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.